Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news-ad-free. That's amazon.com/news-ad-free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hello, I'm Stephen.
And I'm Helen.
And welcome to the New Statesman podcast.
Well, I think we have to deal with, first of all, I guess we should say, as we're recording this, it's still breaking. Ken Livingstone is still on TV, so by the time we get out of the studio, who knows what he will have said. We're joined by our acting staggers editor, Henry Zeffman, to talk about anti-Semitism and Labour and the left more generally. Okay, so for those people who have kind of been in a bunker, Henry, let's do the timeline. Where does it... It begins on Tuesday?
Tuesday at...
Hang on a minute, you're not...
Well, no. So it begins on Monday afternoon, which is, yeah, I think, when the Guido Fawkes website drew attention to a series of anti-Semitic posts that Naz Shah, the relatively newly elected MP for Bradford West, had shared before she became an MP, but not long before she became an MP. We're talking 2014 here.
So people get very kind of... as we will discover later on, people have disagreements about what is and what isn't anti-Semitic. What did she? What were the kind of things that she was? She's posting articles.
She was posting articles and memes, but also typed some of her own comments herself. So, for example, the one which has received the most coverage, or the I think the initial one that Guido uncovered, was that she had shared a meme calling for the transportation, and that's a quote. And think of all the connotations that that word has for Jews, of Israel to the United States of America. She shared that with a, adding her own comment, saying something like, ha ha ha, good idea.
She described that as a solution. Which
she described it as a solution, of
really
course, which is another word
that you probably wouldn't use.
You probably wouldn't. Then in the comments, I think it was on that one, but perhaps on one of her other posts of a similar nature.
It was a poll about online, on those silly polls and the Mirror or the Telegraph does on the bottom of its articles about, is this action in Gaza right? She urged her followers, her Twitter, Facebook friends, and saying, come on, the Jews are rallying.
So, Stephen, John McDonnell, whose PPS she was at the start of the week, seems to have acted quite swiftly, right? Seems to have been relieved of that post very quickly. So initially, Labour had control of the story.
Well, that's the thing that I kind of keep coming back to, is that at 1:30 on Tuesday, which I think was, to let our listeners peer behind the curtain, when we first recorded our segment on this, Labour appeared to be in control of the story. They had quite rightly fired her. My understanding is that it was very much a thing where John McDonnell was like, yeah, you need to go. It was not one of those, oh, I wonder where we go from here. It was a very quick, it was 5 hours from the initial offence to the... And then...
Then there seems to have been a draft of a resignation statement, which Jim Morton at BuzzFeed got hold of. Initially, he was reporting that had been sort of not censored, but certainly edited by the leader's office. It now appears that was an early draft. That was a quite a full-hearted apology.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's unclear why that draft didn't end up being delivered. But that draft was introspective, not just on Naz Shah's part, but Naz Shah being introspective about where anti-Semitism on the left and in elements of the Muslim community has come from. It showed a willingness to engage. I mean, in fact, by the way, it's worth saying, and I'd stop short of saying that Naz Shah comes out well from this, except in relative terms, because, she has admitted to being an anti-Semite. But she has shown a willingness to go on a journey and accuse herself of certain elements of her ignorance. And it was noticeable that the Bradford Synagogue, which is very small and was actually saved from being shut a couple of years ago by
the Muslim campaign.
Community yeah. in Bradford. And they said, you know, she's been great to us since she became an MP. So I think she was probably already on that journey, to her credit. But for whatever reason, that apology wasn't published. The apology that was published was a pretty banal.
It was more along the sorry if I've caused any offence. Yeah.
And then the statement from Jeremy with the kind of the formulation of words which he cannot bring himself to say, I condemn anti-Semitism, without immediately adding the words and racism. I mean, so, you know, obviously, you know, I have a fairly obvious personal stake in racism being bad, but no one thinks that Labour has an endemic problem, you know, going well past Corbyn's election, although, you know, there have definitely been an acceleration of that since the 12th of September. No one thinks there is an endemic problem of that type of
racism
in the Labour Party. That is just not a whereas there are plenty of Jewish left-wingers who feel deeply uncomfortable, including people on what you would describe as the far left, you know, who feel uncomfortable with Jeremy Corbyn's leadership and the direction of the Labour Party and kind of the nascent anti-Semitism, which has been in, yeah, for a long time.
But what I think we need to then talk to is move on to the kind of cluster, whatever, I can't, but afterwards.
The cluster fudge,
there we go, as if we're one of those movies you get on a plane. To say that, so Rupa Haku is the MP for Ealing,
mm-hmm.
went on the Today programme after Naz Shah said, I'm really sorry for being anti-Semitic, and went, this wasn't anti-Semitic.
I had to listen to that interview about 10 times to make sure it wasn't a satire written by Rupa Huck's brother-in-law, Charlie Brooker. I thought it was the most astonishingly repellent thing that I've heard a Labour MP say since September the 12th. And that goes some distance. I mean, really. Rupa Huck has spent the previous day watching a colleague say, I am sorry for saying things that were anti-Semitic. She has watched that and she's thought, whew, that's not anti-Semitic. What a remarkable pathology has taken grip of elements of the left. And Rupa Huck is not on the left of the Labour Party, right? So it shows you how deep that pathology has burrowed, that she can literally watch an anti-Semite profess to being an anti-Semite and say, that's not anti-Semitism. And the ludicrous excuse she offered for that, which was that she likened it on the Today programme to a photo that she once shared accidentally on Twitter of Boris Johnson suspended on a zip wire. That's not just a denial of anti-Semitism. It is a blithe refusal to engage with the seriousness of the problem.
It's not really like there's been a centuries-long campaign of persecution of Boris Johnson on a zip wire.
Not even Marina Wheeler would admit that there's been a centuries-long campaign of prosecution against Boris Johnson.
You say that was one of the most worrying things that you've heard for some time. Enter stage left Livingston Ken.
Oh, yeah. God. But the thing is that I, like, Ken Livingston, this is why it's more worrying. This is why I struggle to know how, with the honourable and very decent exception of Sadiq Khan, Labour is ever, ever, ever going to win any number of votes from Jews for the rest of my lifetime. I mean that. Because we knew about Ken Livingston, right? Ken Livingston is on the left of the Labour Party, a part of the Labour Party, which we already knew had an anti-Semitism problem before Jeremy Corbyn turned up. Ken Livingston was suspended as mayor for making anti-Semitic comments to a Jewish journalist, right? This isn't a shock.
This is when he compared one to a concentration camp guard.
Yeah. So it's, you know, it's...
But then said that he didn't know that the guy was Jewish, I think.
The guy goes, I'm Jewish, I'd like you to retort. It's like, oh no, it's true. I mean, someone who in 2012, the Jewish Labour movement, which in terms of the internal politics of the Labour Party, you have Labour Friends of Israel, which is kind of the more right wing of the two Jewish ginger groups in the Labour Party, and the Jewish Labour movement, which is very much to its left, met with him and went, look, there are a couple of things we'd like you to do. And one of the things he said is, look, face it, most of your people are rich and therefore will not vote for me. Which, I mean, One, actually, if you look at the pattern of ethnic minority voting in Britain, it's actually the only community which has gone noticeably more Tory since it became more affluent is actually the Hindu community, and Ken doesn't go around demonising them. And two, again, for obvious reasons, this idea that the Jewish community is rich is in of itself an anti-Semitic trope. We knew all these things
exactly.
About Ken.
So if I can continue my train of thought, that's exactly the point. We knew about Ken. Yeah. It is its entire separate shocking story that when Labour was run by moderates, they didn't chuck him out. And by the way, some elements of the left who are appalled by Ken Livingstone's comments today might want to revisit how they felt when Tony Blair tried to stop him standing for Mayor of London. That might have been a rather more moral decision than it was portrayed at the time. But secondly, this is exactly the point. We knew about Ken Livingstone. Rupahak is an average new member of the Labour intake. She happened to nominate Jeremy Corbyn, but there are plenty of moderates who did that. And it turns out that she laughs at anti-Semitism. She is the Labour Party now. She is why Labour has ended up in a position where it elects a leader who has called Hamas his friends, whatever his terrible post-hoc rationalisations for that, who has called Raed Salah, who is convicted of repeating the blood libel, which is the ancient anti-Semitic trope that Jews use children's blood to make bread. Jeremy Corbyn called him an honoured citizen when welcoming him to Parliament. He donated money to Paul Eisen, a Holocaust denier. Not just has Labour ended up in the position where he can be elected leader, they end up in the position where he is elected leader. Labour MPs are trying to make it work. Would they have tried to make it work if Labour had somehow ended up in a position where its leader had done the sort of equivalence of that on an Islamophobic plane? No, and rightly so. And I do think there becomes a question. You know, we've had about 15 Labour MPs at the time of podcasting who have called for Ken Livingstone to be suspended. Okay, fine. But there comes a question about what do these people want their epitaph to be? Why are they in politics? Lisa Nandy called for Naz Shah to be suspended long before Jeremy Corbyn actually suspended her after a fashion, right? Lisa Nandy, does she want her epitaph to be she spent the Jeremy Corbyn years fashioning an energy policy which Labour was never ever going to be in government to implement? Or does she want her epitaph to be that she stood up to the scourge of Jew hatred that had taken over the Labour Party? And I know that sounds overwrought and emotional, but I think when she looks in the mirror at the end of her career, she and the many, many other Labour MPs who are not anti-Semitic, far from it, will have to reckon
with
that.
Well, let's talk for a minute about somebody who has come out of this well from the Labour Party, which is Sadiq Khan, you know, who has faced a campaign from the people behind Zach Goldsmith, you know, that has attempted to portray him as a radical, has, I think, dabbled with Islamophobia. But he has always been somebody who's spoken out against anti-Semitism. And he's come out and said,
well,
hasn't he?
I mean, he has been since he became mayor. We talked about Ken Livingstone being suspended earlier when he was mayor, and Sadiq Khan opposed that suspension. So that's worth noting. But I must say, I have been tremendously impressed, as has much of the Jewish community, by the way. The Jewish Chronicle wrote, I think it was an editorial, saying that Sadiq Khan has been a better mayoral candidate for the Jewish community than Zach Goldsmith. And given Zach Goldsmith's half Jewish, that says something. So yes, he has been very good, and I think the events of today and the previous days will probably do a lot to hamper the considerable and honest and decent efforts that he's made to rebuild bridges with the Jewish community.
What I don't understand with, and Stephen, we've talked about this in the podcast before, you know, Ed Miliband as a Labour leader was highly critical of Israel's policies. That is a very legitimate thing to do. It is a very right-wing, very nationalistic state. He never got accused of anti-Semitism. I mean, being from a Jewish family himself, I'm sure it factored into that. But it is one of those things that we've got to this stage now where it's a kind of, I don't know, it is a dog whistle. In the same way that people say, oh, you can't say anything about immigration without being called a racist, as a kind of, you can't say anything about Israel without being kind of accused of being anti-Semitic. It's become a kind of crutch on the left, hasn't it, that actually what we're always talking about here is they're just honestly trying to criticize Israel's policies, and lots of people are taking that as being a coded message.
Yeah, I mean, the thing is, the problem is it's nonsense, isn't it? I mean, you know, at one, as Ed Miliband showed, but also like the existence of Haaretz, which is effectively the Israeli equivalent of Salon or Slate, you know, which, you know, is virulently critical of Benjamin Netanyahu. I mean, you know, Lisa Nandy herself, you know, who did quite rightly come out and say, you know, we can't have people saying things like that in the Labour Party, has described Netanyahu as an obstacle to peace in the Middle East. In my view, she is 100% correct. I mean, the problem is, yeah, like, Israel accounts for about half of the global population of Britain's Jews. When we talk about Britain's anti-Semitism problem, we talk about the fact that in the part of North London where I live, there are now guards on state schools which are majority Jewish. Right?
Oh, yeah, well, like, I mean, yeah, you won't find a single synagogue or Jewish school in the country where that isn't the case.
Yeah, like that, and that has, you know, very little to do with the politics of the Likud party. I think the problem is there are kind of three strains at work in the Labour Party which have led to our present discontents. The first is that it is very easy for people to nod along when they say, oh, there's a problem in the culture about racism, anti-Semitism, sexism, and then people get very, very het up the second you go, by the way, you are part of the culture. No one in Britain is not part of a continent which 70 years ago committed a pogrom on an industrialised scale. That doesn't go away. It lingers within the culture. I mean, that is why...
I think it's based on a very narrow understanding of privilege and the way that the left has kind of ended up thinking about what constitutes somebody who is oppressed or who isn't. And I think that the left has a problem both with sexism in that it doesn't really... Often you hear people who don't really think that women have got any problems. Certainly not, you know, middle-class women, you know, women that they might know. I hear this overtone all the time from people on the far left and the hard left who I talk to who just don't think that anything bad really happens to middle-class women. And I think the same thing has happened with Jewish communities. Yes, there's a sort of sense you might... Yes, of course you might have had some problems in the past with that whole unpleasant business in the middle of the 20th century. But we all know now that Jews aren't really oppressed now. Don't you think that's what's driving it? Black people are properly oppressed, but actually,
and it's also,
Jews don't have
it's also
to
bound
about.
Into being critical of the United States government, which is fair enough. The United States government has done a lot of things which are suboptimal, to put it mildly. But there is a sense that because Israel is a close ally of the United States government, and because there is a widespread view on the left, you know, ranging actually from some fairly, you know, there are Liz Kendall supporters, you know, in the parliamentary party who I would say subscribe wholeheartedly to the idea that the United States is primarily a muddying force in global politics. And that contributes to part of it. And then this sense that the left is righteous, exactly as you say, then therefore, you know, it's always very, very difficult to look at the mote in your own eye. I mean, the thing I found striking is we began this week with a lot of right-wingers arguing that the use of the phrase Kenyan ancestry to describe Barack Obama wasn't racist. And we have ended the week with those same right-wing commentators saying, why is the Labour Party tone-deaf on anti-Semitism? And the same people in the Labour Party going, this is a problem, going, but it's not anti-Semitic to criticise Israel. And both of them, if you said, do you accept there's a general cultural problem that we're all mainlining anti-Semitic, racist and sexist tropes, would mostly go, yeah, of course I support that. However, very few people are willing to go, and that includes me.
And that's the root of the matter. And yeah. You drew earlier attention to the fact that Jeremy Corbyn has not, to my knowledge, ever condemned anti-Semitism without aligning it with all other forms of racism in the same sentence. I know why he does that. It's because he doesn't want to admit that he's part of the problem. He doesn't want to confront why Israel was the subject of almost half of his Morning Star columns, which he's been writing since the 80s. Why that is the sole foreign country, above even America, that has attracted so much of his ire for so many years. I don't know if he has it in him to confront what it is about Israel which so irks him. But I think he and a lot of the Labour Party need to do that.
Well, as Stephen alluded to earlier, we've re-recorded this once. Maybe we will have to do that again because events are still fast developing. I just want to ask you, Stephen, first. You know, what's the long... Okay, we don't know. Very something else might happen with Ken by the time that we come out. But what's the long-term effect? Has this really put a stain on the Labour Party long-term?
Yes, I mean, I think the way you have to look at it is during the election, I was knocking on doors in the, you know, when I was doing these Vox Pops on my feature on Wales, still available online to read, and I was going on this door thinking, oh, I haven't talked to very many Conservative voters yet, so I picked a door which had two Mercedes in the front. It was a new house, very well done up. The guy had clearly done well for himself. Very well-dressed man answers the door. He's Asian. I talk to him about politics. He says, I'm worried about Ed Miliband and the SNP. He knifed his brother. I don't like him. I said, so you're going to vote Tory? And he said, I'll never vote Conservative because of Rivers of Blood. A speech which was given in the 1970s. Like, the people... at the time when this guy wasn't alive, but he remembered it being something his parents talk about. The consequences of Ken Livingstone talking about how Hitler's problems with the Jews only started in 1932 will last into a point into the future sufficiently far off that there is a decentest chance that 1932 will be closer to the present day than the time when the Jewish community in Britain forgives large chunks of the Labour Party.
But I'm not sure I agree with you for the reason that Henry outlined earlier, which is that I think that there are far more people who are prepared to give a pass to anti-Semitism than there are to anti-black or Asian racism now.
This is the point. I mean, I think it leaves a stain for the Jewish community, who might otherwise have been minded to vote Labour. The question is, and I think for some people, the bald calculation is the Jewish community is pretty small. They don't need their votes. They can get away with not ever winning Finchley and Golders Green again. And I think that's really what is happening here. I should probably note, just while we have alluded to events going on, so John Landsman, who is in Jeremy Corbyn's inner circle, the sole director of Momentum, and is Jewish himself, has tweeted... a period of silence from Ken Livingstone is overdue, especially on anti-Semitism, racism and Zionism. It's time he left politics altogether. Ken Livingstone is on the NEC slate that John Landsman is backing, Momentum is backing, so that's pretty remarkable. But again, why is John Landsman, to my knowledge, the only member of Momentum to have come out and said that so far? It's because John Landsman's Jewish. Do any non-Jews care? We'll find out in the coming days.
Well, thank you for the moment, Stephen and Henry.
Hi, I'm Caroline.
And I'm Anna.
And we host the pop culture podcast from The New Statesman. Seriously.
If you secretly care more about comics than Jeremy Corbyn, this is the podcast for you.
You can find all our episodes at newstatesman.com/SRSLY.
And now it's time to go down the line to the lobby with George.
Hi, Stephen.
Hi, George.
So this week, the focus in Westminster has moved briefly away from the EU referendum, which completely dominated last week, towards the set of elections coming up. So next Thursday, we have council elections in England, the Scottish parliamentary election, Welsh Assembly election, London mayoral election, and finally, the one that everyone cares the most about, the police and crime commissioner elections. And the local elections for Jeremy Corbyn are his first big electoral test since becoming leader. And the prognosis is not good. John Curtis, perhaps Britain's most respected pollster, has forecast that Labour will lose 170 councillors based on current polling. Yeah. And that would make it the first opposition to lose seats in a local election in a non-general election year since 1985. So that would be an unhappy record for Corbyn to break. So numbers-wise, it doesn't look good. But speaking to both allies and foes of Jeremy Corbyn, it's clear that politically he will pass the test because he can't really fail it. As I write in my column this week, Labour could lose 300 councillors. It could lose the London mayoral election. It could come third, no fourth, in Scotland. And Jeremy Corbyn would be safe.
It is interesting how the mood in the PLP has shifted very sharply from gone in 100 days to gone after the leadership elections to now gone potentially not even by 2020. What about the other parties? What do the Lib Dems see as a good night for them?
Well, they would hope to make gains and to show signs of on the ground of a fight back. I mean, their current poll ratings haven't improved and have maybe even slightly declined since the election. The real problem for them at the moment is much of the media and much of the electorate, more worryingly, sees them as irrelevant. And it is incredibly hard to get coverage when you only have 8 MPs. And this really reinforces Labour's predicament, because in 85, when they lost seats, it was largely due to the SDP Liberal Alliance surging. They're now forecast to lose seats without there being a strong insurgent third party. So UKIP is holding and maybe even slightly rising as the EU gains prominence, but it's hardly surging, and they have one MP who spends most of his time at odds with the leader.
Yeah.
The Lib Dems are irrelevant, and yet Labour is still not capable of landing blows on the Conservatives.
Yeah. The interesting thing is, of course, in Wales, where UKIP didn't really exist in 2011, and they now get 7-8 seats, where Neil Hamilton weirdly will return to West Midlands. What do you think the effect of, we've talked about elsewhere in the podcast, so I don't know, Richard, but the effect of the Ken Livingston remarks on Labour unity? Sadiq Khan has called for him to go, Chris Bryant, Liz Kendall, so people more from the right Labour Party have called him to go, but also some people from the middle and left of the Labour Party, so like Sadiq and Jess Phillips have called for him to go. What do you think will be the end game of that row?
Well, if Ken isn't suspended, then the divisions will endure. Party infighting is never helpful for a party, particularly not ahead of the elections when you want unity and you want to present a competent face to the electorate. A lot of shadow cabinet members and Labour MPs that I spoke to yesterday feel that what Jeremy Corbyn needs to do is to make a set piece speech on anti-Semitism of his own accord to finally sort of put any doubts to bed. But they question whether he's prepared to do that, and if he is, whether he's capable of delivering it in the way required. They feel, you know, he consistently condemns anti-Semitism, but when he does, he tends to say, and all forms of racism. He appears to them incapable of condemning anti-Semitism alone and dealing with that issue in isolation, rather than seeing as part of a general stance against ethnic and racial discrimination.
So, cheery situation to be in as we head into towards local elections. And we'll be back to discuss the fallout of that next week. Right, since we recorded that last session, Ken Livingston has now been suspended from the Labour Party. So from one racism scandal involving one former mayor from one party to another of a different party, my colleague Anoush Shakalian is joining me to talk about Zach Goldsmith, his campaign against Sadiq Khan, and all of the various baggage attached to that. So let's get cracking. Anoush, you've written a lot about this, so for the benefit of our listeners, talk us through what is going on in the London mayoral race.
Okay, so very briefly, at the end of last year, Zach Goldsmith caused a few headlines by one of his leaflets calling Sadiq Khan radical and divisive. Obviously, people thought this was a dog whistle, trying to sound this dog whistle to voters who might be uncomfortable with the idea of a Muslim mayor. And it's kind of spiraled. There's kind of two strands to this story. It's that Goldsmith campaign and the way it's talking about Sadiq Khan, trying to point him out as a Muslim of Pakistani background, but also his leaflets to various parts of London's ethnic communities have been quite reductive in what they assume people's priorities are. So, for example, there were leaflets sent to the Gujarati community talking about protecting their family gold and their businesses, and there were leaflets sent to, you know, the Tamil community saying similar things. Sikhs were receiving leaflets about and letters about Zach Goldsmith's visit to the Golden Temple, and lots of voters have taken offence at this because they think that it's quite crass to be talking about these things that you just assume these groups find important.
Yeah. And he's been widely criticised, including by his own side. I mean, I think it's probably worth, before we go any further, acknowledging the fact that, to be frank, and don't write in Sadiq, but Sadiq Khan is neither radical nor extreme. He is firmly on the soggy centre of the Labour Party. The reason why he's saying that is because Sadiq Khan is a Muslim. That is what Zach Goldsmith is evoking.
Exactly. And the way that he also pointed out that that Sadiq Khan didn't go to Narendra Modi's visit, whereas Zach Goldsmith and David Cameron did. Now, can you imagine Zach Goldsmith putting that on leaflets if Tessa Jowell was the Labour mayoral candidate. It would be completely irrelevant. It is simply because Sadiq Khan has Pakistani roots and is Muslim. He's basically trying to point out to London's Indian voters, who he assumes might have a problem with having a Pakistani or Muslim mayor, look, this guy is Muslim.
Yeah, of course, the polls all forecast a crushing, I mean, yeah, a landslide of biblical proportions for Sadiq Khan. You know, we are talking about, yeah, kind of a Noah's Ark-style defeat for Zach. However, lots of Labour people are nervous. And when you talked to Conservatives about their campaign, they perhaps wouldn't have defended it in a, I think this is very honourable, but they think it's working, don't they?
Yeah, exactly. I've had a few chats with people working on Zach Goldsmith's campaign about this. And they double down on his comments. They say, oh, you know, we think they're fine. We think it's fine to call Sadiq Khan a radical because he's called it that himself. But actually, the way that they talk about it is more to do with strategy than to do with Zach Goldsmith's in the right and Sadiq Khan is a dangerous man. For example, one of the people that I spoke to was saying, well, you know, it might seem a little bit crass, these mail outs that we're sending, but this is all part of modern campaigning. And I thought that was a really interesting phrase that he used because it sounds very Linton Crosby-esque, like it's not nice, but it seems to be working.
And I mean, Labour MPs really do fear it's working. I talked to a senior London MP themselves from an ethnic minority, and they said, yeah, I don't think Zach Goldsmith is a fool. I don't think Zach Goldsmith is racist. So why is he fighting a racist campaign? It must be because it's working. And the fear is then people don't want to admit that they're swayed by this in the polls, or when they're voting in the polls, they see Labour candidate next to Sadiq, but maybe when they get in the ballot box, they'll see the word Sadiq Khan and all of these messages will have a kind of terrible consequence in the ballot box.
Exactly. I was speaking to a Labour advisor who was a candidate last year who is, I think she has Asian roots and she lives in London, called Uma Cameron. And she was saying, she was describing Zach Goldsmith to me with quite a lot of respect. She was saying, oh, he's a cotton wool Tory. He's not like the others. You know, lots of voters clearly quite like his moderate stance. And so, and the implication there was that he's such a nice guy. Why would he be saying things like this? And why would he be steadfastly sticking to this nasty campaign if there wasn't some kind of kernel of it working? And I spoke to her, and also I spoke to a few Gujarati voters back in the constituency I used to live in Ealing. And they were saying, actually, this kind of thing could work, not with my generation, but with my parents' generation or my grandparents' generation.
Yeah. And we know that the elderly are more likely to vote. We know that Sadiq's lead is among voters who are less inclined to vote in general. So there is that slight nervousness, not least because, I mean, to be frank, the Conservatives are saying if they don't want a Muslim like Sadiq Khan holding elected office, they basically are saying they don't want any Muslim at all ever to hold elected office.
Exactly. And also, if this campaign works, then what does that mean for, I mean, what does it mean for London, and what does that mean for modern campaigning in general? Are we allowed to do this kind of campaigning, it seems?
Yeah. And I think the chilling thing is that the reason why we are even talking about it is that they've done it in a not particularly effective and competent way. And my instinct is it won't work because I think that London is not the city than the Conservatives seem to think it is. But if they had been clever on it, if they had done it on Facebook where only people who actually were meant to see it had seen it, then we wouldn't be saying, oh, I wonder why they're so smug. Oh, we'd be going, oh, isn't Zach Goldsmith a lovely One Nation Conservative? And I find it kind of chilling to think, and maybe even in 2020, political targeting will be sufficiently advanced and we just won't know that this is what's going on underneath the iceberg.
Yeah, exactly. Part of the reason why everyone has even heard of this is because people have been tweeting the leaflets that they've taken pictures of on their phones. So we haven't seen it in that Facebook arena. But what I've heard other Labour people saying is that they think Zach Goldsmith might not be thinking that he's going to win by this campaign, but this campaign is useful for the Tories in 2020 because it's linking Jeremy Corbyn to Sadiq Khan using this they've shared a platform with extremists line, which is a similar kind of fear campaign that the Tories ran last election, but with the SNP instead.
Well, this has been a cheerful week on the podcast. Don't worry, next week we'll be discussing Captain America Civil War and Batman versus Superman, so that will be a nice uplift, as well as hearing a very, very tired Stephen Bush come off hours of live blogging from the local election. So we'll be back next.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states.
UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Sweet. And welcome back to You Ask Us. The clue is in the title. You ask us a question, we try to answer it. And this week's question, which I'm going to have to kind of cut down for reasons of pith, is from Amanda Scott, who's asked, is TTIP a reason to vote Leave? Obviously, Obama has said we'll be back of the queue for any TTIP-style deal, which from her perspective sounds like quite a good deal.
So I went on an odyssey this week of discovering what TTIP actually is, having seen it as an acronym and vaguely been sort of knew that I should be kind of against it or at least worried about it. I talked to War on Want and the National Health Action Party, and then I also talked to the Adam Smith Institute, the libertarian think tank, who are unsurprisingly more in favour of it than the others. So basically, the Transatlantic Trade and Investment Partnership will be the biggest trade deal in the world. It will codify lots of things that have happened informally already between America and the EU. The campaigners' concern about it, I think Alan Beattie, the FT, had this idea that it said, you know, it will shred state healthcare systems and force American Frankenfoods down our throats. That's a slight simplification of the objections, but not, you know, a good précis, I think, of them. So the idea is that there are a couple of things that are really worrying about it. There's a sort of semi-secret tribunal system which is codified in it, and which
ISDS,
except it's not called that anymore because that would be too simple. In which companies can sue governments essentially for restricting their ability to do business. So there's this thing called indirect expropriation, which is supposed to be so a kind of corrupt kleptocrat can't just seize things off people, basically, mm-hmm. by various means. But the worry is that things like, for example, Obama cancelling the Keystone Pipeline, for example. Well, that's a bit sad to the company that was trying to make the Keystone Pipeline. Do they have a case for damages? That's what they want to know. Or you might say that, you know, if you cancelled a big train contract, for example, or you decided to renationalise the railways in various ways, would companies not only be able to sue for money they'd already invested, but for the loss of future profits? Mm-hmm. So that's kind of an interesting thing. The second thing is whether or not the US and the EU have very different food safety standards. For anyone who's ever been to a supermarket in the US will know that there is some weird stuff, and they feed some weird stuff to cattle and things like that. So things like bans, 40% of grain from the US can't be imported to the EU because it's got banned pesticides in it.
Well, that's terrifying.
Yeah, well, but also there are some other things
I'm mainly talking about eating in the United States.
Yeah.
Not I've ever been to the United States. Although if a listener would like to pay for me to go.
It's too late for me. I've eaten in the United States. Okay. It's all over. And beef as well. I've eaten beef. But also, it goes the other way as well. The Americans are always slightly horrified by the concept of unpasteurized cheese. Like, why are you eating this cheese that's swimming in bacteria? So that those kind of things, the worry is that all these sort of safety legislation that's been built up by the EU, size of battery chicken cages, that kind of thing, would that all be eroded as we essentially equalize with the US and kind of more and more take on their standards? In terms of the NHS, it's quite hard to unpick exactly what it is. When I spoke to the National Health Action Party, you know, they make the case that they believe the creation of the internal market has already started that process, and it's kind of, this would just really kind of give it a turbo boost. But it's quite hard to point to any one thing that would sort of happen on day one of TTIP. I think the most interesting thing to note is So Sam Bowman, who is from the Adam Smith Institute, as I say, this right-wing think tank, kind of said that the trouble is that the secrecy with which it's been conducted, and it has been conducted in secrecy, MEPs are allowed to see it, but they have to go into a special room and leave their phone behind, and they're only allowed a certain amount of time, and they can only, you know, they haven't published the full communiques. That level of secrecy...
So what we're seeing is only the TTIP of the iceberg.
but essentially his argument is that level of secrecy has made it look a lot more sinister than it is. What we know about the EU is it's not deregulation crazy. And actually War on Want say one of the things that the US want financial regulations exempted from, because of the Dodd-Frank Act, they're ahead of Europe in kind of dealing with bad banks. And, you know, he had this great quote, this is Sam, saying, you know, there doesn't, it looks like a sort of, you know, the, because of the secrecies, people are trying to make out it's kind of a conspiracy theory between the EU and big business to kind of deregulate everything. And I wish that were true, because, you know, he's a libertarian. That's what he does want, fewer barriers to trade. So TTIP, yeah, it's difficult. It looks quite, if you're a kind of conspiracy aficionado, there are lots of things in it you can see in a very judgy light. The most interesting thing that came across is lots of people just don't think it's going to happen. It seems to be that if Obama's presidency runs out the clock, it's then quite unlikely to kind of get anywhere. And
because
every
European state has to vote it through at some point. The Senate and Congress have to vote it through, which is very much not a slam dunk. The assumption isn't the next Senate will be more anti-free trade than this one. I mean, I guess, obviously, you're much more across it than I am, but it feels slightly strange to me, the argument that it would be a good way to get out of trying to emulate American capitalism at its worst would be to leave the EU
and leave all the social protections.
And instead leave it to the wisdoms of David Cameron, or in fact, the reality is whatever Brexit mad,
balding man that the Tory party
inflict on us afterwards.
Yes, exactly. If you think that a post-Brexit Boris Johnson prime ministership is not going to be massively concerned about making battery chicken cages larger, or what, you know, acid washing of meat, or making sure that there's no more private entry into, you know, and hospitals and work in the National Health Service. I think that realistically, if those are the things that you care about, staying inside the EU is more your bag. Although I can see that there are obvious objections to TTIP, and that is TTIP in a nutshell. You've been listening to the New Statesman podcast, presented by me, Helen Lewis, with Stephen Bush. Our producer is India Bork, and our music is Devil with a Devil by the Underscore Orchestra, licensed under Creative Commons. You can find us on iTunes or at newstatesman.com/podcast.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hello, Freddie here. I want to tell you about a new way you can support the New Statesman's independent journalism. Every morning I send out Morning Call, our daily newsletter covering everything you need to know about British politics. It's free to sign up, plus for just £3 a month, you'll get a recommended daily piece of ours sent to you in full, plus exclusive polling analysis from Ben Walker, a weekly update from Will Dunn, and our featured piece on Sundays. If you enjoy this podcast, you'll love Morning Call. Head to morningcall.substack.com and subscribe now.